Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Okay, this is Heather Olson Beale, and I'm here today with Kathy Soper, a Bloggernacle queen. Is that fair? No.
Wow. I don't know about Bloggernacle queen.
I feel like I'm rubbing elbows with the rich and famous.
Oh, please.
Okay, I was going to read something from your website, and then you can add to it or subtract to it if you want.
Okay.
So, on Kathy's website, it says that Kathy is the wife of one, mother of seven, a memoirist, essayist, editor, nonprofit CEO, practicing Mormon, depression survivor, Down syndrome advocate, Greek-blooded American, Maryland-bred Utah transplant, word twist addict, and BSG groupie. Not necessarily in that order.
Yeah, that sounds just about right.
So let me, I had told you that I wanted to ask if you would say, this is just kind of a ticky-tack question, but it's important to me, whether there's a preferred way, or whether you would prefer for people to say that you have a son with Down syndrome. I mean, are there certain ways that people refer to children that you like, or are there things that people say that make you cringe?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
Tell, because
I have to temper that by saying, you know, before I had Thomas, there were all kinds of things that I said that were not at all intended to be insensitive. And so I do not want to be the kind of person who's walking around getting angry because someone phrases something a certain way, especially when there's no intent to offend, then it's kind of silly to take offense. Now, in the early months after Thomas's birth, I was very touchy because anything anyone said, you know, just it was like punching all these fresh bruises that I had.
Right.
And so I was very difficult for me to have conversations about Thomas for a while. I was just very sensitive and vulnerable and raw. So, generally speaking, I do prefer it when people say a son with Down syndrome instead of a Down syndrome kid,
okay.
You know, a daughter with Down syndrome rather than this Down syndrome girl, simply because it's important to refer to these individuals as individuals first and not as a diagnosis first. Like you wouldn't walk around and say, well, that's my diabetes brother and that's my cancer mom.
Right.
And you don't label people with conditions, other conditions that way. Of course, Down syndrome is not a disease or an illness, but still people use it as a qualifier in a way that can suggest that it makes you a different kind of being than the rest of us,
Okay.
When really it doesn't.
Well, I just found myself when I was typing the notes, and I started to write that, okay, they have a son with Down syndrome, and then I was like, oh, no, do I say Down syndrome son? And then I was thinking, well, I should just be able to say son, and then I thought, well, no, I think it is important that he has Down syndrome because that's what your memoir deals with, so it's not like we can't say it at all, but I did just wonder, not for you to be, you know, criticizing, but in terms of just educating people, what was the most appropriate
way? There's, you know, different people have different feelings about it. Some parents are extremely sensitive about language.
Okay.
I'm kind of more moderate, but there's a whole range. Like, George Will wrote a blurb for the back cover of Gifts, and he thinks people first language is just a load of baloney. People first language being saying, you know, son with Down syndrome rather than Down syndrome son.
Oh.
He just thinks that that's a load of crap. So,
okay.
And he's a very strong
advocate.
Down syndrome advocate. Okay. So there's a real range. And on the other end, there are people who have undertaken a very heated and sincere campaign to try to get the word retarded classified as like a hate crime kind of word, which I think is extremely extreme.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of in the middle of the spectrum,
okay,
personally.
Okay.
You'll find people on both ends.
Find people on both ends. All right. So let's talk a little bit about, I've got a list here of questions more specific to the book and that center around Down syndrome.
Okay.
So I thought I'd ask you to begin, just if you could, and hopefully, I'm assuming that you're aware of this, give us a little bit of history in terms of Down syndrome and the way it's sort of been handled in the United States. Like, can you say how were Down syndrome children or children with Down syndrome treated, like, back in the day? And are there differences now? Is that anything that you've engaged with at all, that idea, kind of the progress that's been made?
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about that. There was very much a lot of social, cultural pressure to institutionalize children with Down syndrome throughout the 20th century. It was the norm for parents not to raise their child, but to send them to an institution. That began to change in the early 70s. There were some parents who were kind of pioneers. Well, not kind of, they were pioneers in that they determined they wanted to raise their children. And so that was not a popular idea for a while. I mean, they really got a lot of backlash on that and a lot of unwillingness to help, because the attitude kind of was, well, if you're going to take this upon yourself, you know, don't expect the schools or whatever to help you out.
Mm.
And so there was some of the women that I've talked to who are older, whose children with Down syndrome are adult age, they tell me stories about how hard they had to fight just for basic inclusion, basic rights for their kids to be able to have opportunities similar to what typical children have. And it's changed quite a bit since then, these last several decades. It has been, it's now very much the norm for parents to keep their children at home. In fact, parents who opt to give their children with Down syndrome for adoption are pretty ostracized, you know, more privately than publicly. But parents of kids with Down syndrome tend to look down on families who don't keep their children at home and raise their children themselves. So that's, overall, it's a very, very positive change.
Mm-hmm.
I still think it's important for there to be some flexibility, because people's circumstances can vary so widely. But overall, it's been a tremendous change. Now,
yeah.
The big change in education has been the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act,
mm-hmm.
which guarantees people with disabilities fitting education just like any other child. Like, they cannot be discriminated against because of their disability, and services need to be provided in public education for all children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a tremendous law that was passed, and it has led to doors opening for all kinds of kids with disabilities. Sometimes there can be some rancor, some bitterness in the educational circles, simply because there is this law and certain things are mandated through it, certain services, a degree of attention and care, that some parents resent that, because children who don't qualify for special education but still have other needs don't get the same kind of services.
Mm-hmm.
Children who are gifted and talented don't get that level of attention and care from the public schools. And I can sympathize with that, because I have several of my children are profoundly gifted, needed special education for gifted kids. And it has been extremely frustrating, especially when they were in elementary school, for them to be stuck in classrooms where, you know, they were not challenged. They were not engaged at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that every kid needs an education that, that fits their needs. And unfortunately, because of budget constraints, mm-hmm. And the lack of there being laws to guarantee services for kind of kids on the other end of the spectrum, usually gifted programs get cut first. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to cut gifted programs before they cut any services for disabled kids. But this, I think that's, I hate to say it, but I think that as much as I believe gifted education is important, I think that it's more vital for kids with disabilities to get the services they're getting. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a tough thing to say aloud, but I think it's true. I think mm-hmm. that these kids, their chances of having success in life in terms of being able to be independent and have social lives, it just hinges on these inclusion opportunities when they're young in the public school system. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pleased that the law is in place and that services are offered. Of course, they vary very much from state to state, and Utah is a state with one of the kind of the worst packages of services for kids with disabilities.
Really?
So that's, yeah. Well, that kind of goes with the whole Utah being at the bottom of the barrel as far as dollars spent per year per child for education. You know, we've been at the very bottom of the list for a long time, and so this kind of goes along with that.
But they sort of like, and I don't even know who I mean by they, but I'm an education professor, so at least in circles sort of that I operate in, Utah seems like they like to say, and look how well we do with how little money we spend. So it's sort of, yeah. From my perspective, it's a point of pride. We spend so little money, but look what we're still capable of doing. So
yes, yes. Well, they try to frame it that way. I've heard it framed that way. Uh-huh. And I guess I really wouldn't know any differently if I didn't know people all across the country and know what kind of services their kids are getting. Uh-huh. And be able to kind of compare and contrast that way. And there's a stark difference. And some families will move. You know, they will pick a state to live in based on what services will be available for their child. That's not an option for us. That's not something that we would do anyway. But for some families, it's that important to have that support mm-hmm. that they will just pack up and move everything in order to be able to get the help that they need.
Okay. Well, those are some pretty big shifts you just described in, you know, 30 or 40 years.
Yes.
That's good.
Yeah, it has been just a night and day change in many respects. There's still a lot of progress to still be made. There's still a very painful stigma, I think, that we're all aware of for people with disabilities in our culture. And while we're more apt to give lip service about the value of such individuals, we're still not very eager to kind of live according to the platitudes that we like to kind of spout off at the mouth. That was a difficult thing for me when Thomas was born, and I got a lot of people kind of telling me how lucky I was and, oh, congratulations, you know, he's so special. And I would much rather hear that than, you know, these pitiful responses and, oh, no, that's what a tragedy and that's the most awful thing I can imagine. But at the same time, it was painful to hear those sentiments from people that I would have bet money on the fact that they did not want to have a child with Down syndrome themselves. Mm-hmm. So we're quick to congratulate others, you know, when it happens to somebody else mm-hmm. and say, oh, you know, it'll be such a loving child and how wonderful. But almost without exception, we are glad it's happening to our neighbor and not to us. Mm-hmm. And so that can make it difficult to hear some of the cheerful things that people say with the best of intentions.
Right.
You know,
right.
With the very best of intentions. But you're still aware. You're still aware as a parent of the gap mm-hmm. between that cheerfulness and the reality of it all. Mm-hmm. And that can be hard.
Okay, so what would you say are some of the either stereotypes or misconceptions associated with children or people who have Down syndrome? Like all I would know was that people tend to say, oh, well, you know, things like, oh, children who have Down syndrome, they're so loving and they're so happy. Like, that's all I can think of. Is that, I mean,
those are the primary ones. Yeah, okay. Those are the most pronounced stereotypes. And they're stereotypes for a reason. You know, all stereotypes have their foundation in, at least to some extent, in reality. And that's how we come to repeat these things all the time. But it's important to remember that kids with Down syndrome are, they're each individuals. Mm-hmm. Okay, they have an extra 21st chromosome, but all of their other genetic material is the same as a typical child's. And it would be pretty silly if we were to try to classify an entire population of children based on, you know, one aspect of their genetic makeup and make generalizations based on that. It's especially damaging when people tend to use compliments, again, with the best of intentions and far better than the negative stereotyping, which was in place for so long. But it can still be a way of setting a child with Down syndrome apart from his or her peers and a reason to not include. It's kind of like, okay, this child's so special. He's so special, I'm not going to invite him to my kid's birthday party. You know, it's a way of distancing self from other.
Okay.
It can still be a way of putting distance between kids with Down syndrome and typical kids. And that might sound awfully whiny for a parent to say, like, oh, I wish people would stop talking about how great my kid is.
Okay.
And how special they are and how loving they are. And I can see that. I can see people saying, rolling their eyes and saying, well, geez, what do you want? You know, how can we possibly please you?
Okay.
But it's what has happened over the past several decades is that there has been a shift from regarding people with Down syndrome as subhuman, mm-hmm. you know, less than human. And now kind of the pendulum has swung the other way, and we tend to classify them as superhuman, as something beyond human. Like, there's a lot of rhetoric about angel babies. Even amongst parents of kids with Down syndrome, this is a very, very popular metaphor to use. And many parents really like it. They find it very comforting mm-hmm. to think about their child as a special angel from heaven sent specially to them. As far as our house goes, gosh, Thomas, in most ways, he is the highlight of our family in a lot of ways. He's our easiest child in a lot of ways. He has single-handedly brought more love into our family than any other single family member has. And I can say all of those things without reservation, you know, even though they, in some ways, play into some of the stereotypes that can be troubling. Mm-hmm. Again, the stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason. And yeah, Thomas has this capacity to evoke love in other people. Mm-hmm. You can see it in their faces when they interact with him. He himself is not particularly social or loving the way that kids with Down syndrome are often depicted to be. He has autism as well as Down syndrome. And so the social intelligence, which is often one of the talents that kids with Down syndrome have, that's not the case for him. He doesn't run up and hug strangers. He doesn't climb on your lap and tell you, I love you, I love you, I love you. He's not socially outgoing at all. And he's a very introverted, focused little boy who shows a lot of affection to his family, but he does not fit the stereotype of the hugging kid. Okay. You know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So people are sometimes surprised by that. They can see he has Down syndrome because of his facial features, and they'll come up to him and they'll kneel down and they'll have a big smile on their face and they'll, Thomas! Like, this is going to be their new best friend. And he just, sometimes he just turns away. Sometimes he actually takes his hand and pushes it outward as if to say, go away. Sometimes he'll run away. There's an assumption there that he's going to love them readily because he has Down syndrome.
Wow.
and again, I don't want to make a fuss about people being friendly to my kid, you know? That's just stupid. But I think it's revealing. I think it reveals the assumptions that we carry about people with Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to be aware of that and to hopefully change that to some degree and realize that a kid with Down syndrome shouldn't necessarily love you any more quickly than any other child. I mean, I think that's a really unfair expectation to put on a segment of the population.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I mean, you're talking, sorry, I know I'm interrupting, but you're not limiting this to Mormon people, or are you? This angel baby idea.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
It's very widespread.
Okay.
I think it's hugely important for parents to not feel like there's only one way to think about it. There's only one true explanation for all of these millions of people who have disabilities. It's too complex for that. And I don't begrudge anyone, you know, however they want to frame their situation to bring them comfort. You know, I don't want to try to take that away from anybody. But I do think that when it moves beyond an individual's perspective or a family's perspective, and it kind of seeps into the cultural fabric and becomes an assumption that everybody believes this way and that there's no other way to think about disability, then that's a problem, especially in the church. When you are categorizing somebody as special, even in a positive sense, and you're putting them up on a pedestal, you are distancing them from their peer group. You're distancing them from the rest of humankind. And it might not appear to be a problem because you're doing it in a nice way, right? You're doing it in a complimentary way.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be similar dynamics to the problem of putting women on pedestals.
Oh, I've been thinking that as you've been talking, and I've been thinking in my mind, like, can I bring this up? Or is she going to think this is crazy? Because I feel the same way. I'm like, it's totally not meaningful for me at all. In fact, it is offensive to feel like someone's trying to persuade me. Like in the Ensign or in conference talks or whatever, someone's trying to persuade me that women are so honored and treasured.
Yeah.
I'm like, if it takes that much persuasion, something's rotten in Denmark. I mean, really, I'm like, that's just not. But since you brought it up, then I can talk about it. Yeah, no, I feel
I'm glad you understand, though, what I'm trying to get at, because when I'm describing my perspective on these things, I just know that it could be easily misunderstood. It could be misconstrued as a really kind of sour grapes mentality. So I'm actually glad that you know what I'm getting at here, and that's kind of over.
Go ahead. Sorry. was going to say, when I've mentioned that issue about women to people, I think people, often the audience also thinks that I'm like sour grapes. Kind of like, well, gee, so you're saying that you want for women to be treated differently, or you want for them to have different status or whatever, and now, you know, now you're saying that you don't like for us to say how great you are. And then I'm like, I really don't. I really don't want you to say how great and important women are. I want you just to talk about how great people are, you know?
Exactly, yep. There's this missing step between women are inferior to men, that, and the pendulum again has swung so that as far as what we say, not what we really practice with our behavior, but what we tell each other is that women are superior in some ways, especially spiritually, to men. And it's like we completely missed that middle spot of women are human beings.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you swing from women are the weaker, inferior sex to, you know, women are in some very important ways superior. And neither one of those things is desirable.
Yeah.
Both of those approaches, are degrading to women.
Yeah.
And it's the same with kids or individuals with disabilities, the greatest compliment that you can give a person with a disability is to regard them as your peer, a human being, someone who might be different from you in some respects, but has much more in common with you than they have not in common with you.
Okay.
And I think it's a really natural thing to come up with an explanation for a reality that's very complex and frightening and painful. We want to have comforting explanations for these very difficult realities. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just how we are, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think it's important to realize that the stories we tell in our culture about disability, where it comes from, what it signifies, that those are things that we have constructed ourselves, and those are paradigms that we have built to meet our own needs, and they're not necessarily based on any sort of truth with a capital T.
Mm-hmm. Let me, I'm going to ask you a question again about, well, or just tell you about briefly about this article that I read about autism that has to do with this idea, our conception of, yeah, what it means to have a disability or just the definition of disability. I read it a few years ago and wish that I had printed it or kept it because I've wanted it many times since then, haven't been able to find it. But there was a whole issue, I think, in Newsweek about autism. And there was a piece in there written from someone who was in charge of or just a participant in this autism advocacy group. And what this group, this was just so hard for me to get my brain around. What they were wanting to do, what they were advocating for, was to remove the stigma associated with autism and for us to stop considering autism, for society to stop considering autism as like a disease or a condition or a disability, and to just say it's not that nothing's wrong with people who have autism, it's just the way they are.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that and thinking, wow, I mean, I get where you don't want it to be stigmatized and you don't want for people to be harmed, but it also seems like, but are you really then denying that, I mean, it does seem like there are real issues and challenges associated with having autism, and it seems like it would be the same way with Down syndrome. So
right.
Does that resonate with you, or do you feel like, do you consider it a disability, or do you feel like this is just the way Thomas is? I mean, are you okay calling it a disability or a...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I absolutely call it a disability. There's kind of a litmus test that parents of kids with Down syndrome give each other, which is, if you could take away your child's Down syndrome, would you? And some parents vehemently argue that they would not.
That's what this article was saying about autism, too. It was stunning. But sorry, I totally interrupted.
No, well, it's... Okay, you can kind of see the benefit to that line of thinking, but also the danger of taking it to such an extreme. Okay, it's very important for there to be a balance between stressing similarities mm-hmm. between people and acknowledging and accepting differences. And there's kind of two different schools of thought, and one emphasizes sameness, and one emphasizes, you know, we're different and there's nothing wrong with us, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. It's kind of similar to in the deaf community. There are two very opposite philosophies, and one is that deafness, there's nothing wrong with being deaf, and deaf people do not need to even try to adapt to hearing people's culture. They can have their own culture.
Yes.
And then there's, on the opposite side of the spectrum, there are the people who believe that this is a problem to be fixed, and every single effort should be made to help this child be as much like a hearing child as possible. Mm-hmm. And I have sympathies on both sides. Mm-hmm. Okay, for Thomas, I very much want him to have whatever opportunities are truly beneficial for him. Mm-hmm. Whatever will be genuinely helpful in enabling him to have a happy life. Mm-hmm. All of those things I want to have for him, and I work hard to help him have those things. At the same time, I don't believe that a typical child's life is the only version of a good life. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that Thomas he's missing out on many things that his brothers and sisters do. Mm-hmm. So I can argue it that way, but I could also point out that as far as he's concerned, he's having a great life. Mm. He has his own version of success. He has his own kinds of goals and interests. Mm-hmm. And I think it's harmful for us to assume that the only happy child is the child who's on the soccer team and plays piano, mm-hmm. and gets a part-time job when he's 16 and serves a full-time mission and marries some cute little blonde thing in the temple. I mean, it's just not right to mm-hmm. hold that up as the only version of success, mm-hmm. the only version of happiness. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there needs to be flexibility there. I think there needs to be acknowledgement that the normal, you know, quote, normal way of doing things isn't always necessarily the best way, and that there are changes in perspective that can come to you, and they certainly have come to me, where from reading my book, you already know that I had a lot of very strong feelings about the importance of my children's academic intelligence.
Yes.
Before Thomas was born.
Right.
And I knew all the right things to say. I knew all the right things to believe. And I could present myself as someone who was mature enough to, even though I, of course, liked the perks that came from having gifted kids, that in my heart of hearts, I didn't believe that made them any better than any other child. You know,
right.
I could convince you of that, but that's not what I truly believed. Mm-hmm. And the change that has come has been so fundamental and so dramatic that it is it's adjusted the way I look at everything in life. And I guess what my point is that there are other ways of looking at life and people in the world where it really turns the usual priorities and values upside down. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite the opposite from what you've been accustomed to seeing and thinking and believing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I thought that was very interesting in your book when you were talking about that whole idea of sort of judging, and you can correct me if I don't characterize it appropriately, but judging our success and judging our children's success according to what they do or what they
yes.
achieve, I think
yeah.
that's a very American thing. Just
yes.
the whole work ethic, individualism, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And then I also think that's a very Mormon thing. So that to me seems like it could be a great combination where you could have people that work very hard and are successful, although, you know, by whatever definition. But it could also be, on the other side of that, a real dangerous cocktail, I guess. Because, you know, in the Mormon church, I think we have, and maybe even for particularly for women, kind of this checklist mentality. And then we even have the whole after grace you're saved, after all that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm from the South, so that's a big thing that I've sort of had to engage with, is lots of other people here saying it's just grace. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
matter what you do, because you just need to accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, and he makes all that up. And then we have
mm-hmm.
there is that grace, because we're never going to be good enough, and so we always need him to kind of make up the gap, but you need to have done this, you know?
Yes.
So, that seems like sometimes it could be, like I said, a very not good orientation, where rather than valuing people for who they are, we're valuing them for what they do.
What they do, yeah. Absolutely. I think that the kind of values that we perpetuate in Mormon culture in the United States can very easily lead to illusions, half-truths, and outright falsities about life, people, the universe, everything. You know, it's very easy to have your vision askew and have your mind darkened when you are believing these fundamental things about the value of human beings, and you're wrong. You know, like mm-hmm. if you have, like I had, I'll stop saying you and just say I, you know, I had a way of evaluating people. Mm-hmm. I had a way of ranking people. I had a way of judging myself and others. And when I came to find out that that was all just based on fallacy, that was a huge, just enormous sea change in my life. And all of the kind of constructs that I had in my mind, my whole framework for understanding the world just kind of crumbled, and I had to find a different one, you know, build a new one. Mm-hmm. And it's been wonderful. It's been exhilarating. You know, I'm finding that the truth is so much better than the lies we tell ourselves when we're scared. You know, we tell ourselves things, we make up stories, we construct these narratives about why things are the way they are and how things actually are. And we do it because we're scared and we're trying to make sense of a complex and frightening world. Mm-hmm. But what I'm continually finding every single time is that as those illusions fall away, even though it's painful and you're left kind of raw and naked and vulnerable, without that protective covering that's helped you to feel safe, that the truth is actually much more beautiful and much less frightening than we tend to think it will be. You know, we hide from it, but it's actually far better than what we invent in its place.
Okay, so I'm interested with you. So you're saying that you sort of ditched that idea, that whole like achievement, like meritocracy thing, and replaced it with something else. So like in terms of the way you look at your kids, could you characterize or yourself how you go about evaluating or assessing yourself or your kids if it's not according to that?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I don't know how succinctly I can articulate it because it's still something in process and that's a pretty complex thing. But at the most obvious level, the way I regard my children and my dreams and hopes for them have everything to do with how they feel and who they are. It sounds like such a terrible cliche, but it's true. How they feel, who they are inside. Mm-hmm. I have pretended to believe that for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I can't claim that I've fully converted. You know, I'm sure there are still parts of me that are hanging on to these false ideas of what really matters and that those will be, you know, stripped away as more experiences come to me in life. But certainly there's been enough of a change for me to be able to turn around and look and say, oh, that's what I believed before and I'm not there anymore.
Okay.
When I had, you might remember in the book, the conversation I had with my daughter, Elizabeth, who was, her grades were starting to fall. Mm-hmm. And I got very, very uptight about that because she, from very early childhood, has just been tremendously gifted and so full of potential. And I was so angry at her, you know, to have so much potential, you know, especially compared to her new baby brother who had so little potential by comparison as far as academics goes. And how she was, you know, she couldn't throw it away. She couldn't waste that ability. She couldn't. And I was determined to compel her to make certain choices, to live her life a certain way. I was just determined this child has got to do X, Y, and Z in order for her to be happy and in order for me to be happy. You know, she has to take, there was a scholarship that she was working towards for a time, and I just could not conceive of her not pursuing that scholarship. I couldn't conceive of her not going to college. Just these things I was so absolutely sure had to happen to secure her happiness and mine, all of a sudden just kind of fell away, and it was really a dramatic experience to hear these things coming out of your mouth that you realize you don't believe anymore, mm-hmm. and to just stop kind of mid-sentence and say, oh my gosh, up until 10 seconds ago, I would have looked you right in the eye and told you that if you do not go to college, a good college, and do well there, mm-hmm. that you could not be happy and that I could not be happy as your mother. Mm-hmm. And then that to have that just kind of collapse and to realize that has absolutely nothing to do with true happiness is just a revolutionary experience.
Yeah.
You know, you're just never the same after that.
Right.
What it has done for me as a parent is removed, I would say, somewhere between 3/4 and 5/6 of all my anxiety as a
wow.
parent. Because previous to the adjustment that came after Thomas's birth, I, again, had these ideas of how things needed to be and what happiness was and what mattered and how to get it, how to be successful in life. And in order to have these things, I had to not only push myself really hard, but push other people. Mm-hmm. I was very much a micromanaging kind of mother who was intensely concerned about all the different facets of her children's being every hour of the day. In fact, I often felt like I was kind of living their lives as well as mine. You know, I was emotionally in their heads and in their business constantly because I thought that's what a good mother did.
Mm.
I thought that a good mother ensures that her children are doing what they need to do to be happy. And that has changed dramatically for me. And my
wow.
approach is much more about trusting the innate goodness in my children and also the need for them to learn by experience. And it's just become so clear that they're not, you know, these empty hard drives that you need to program with all the right things in order to function a certain way and be successful. They are already good. You know, they already have this amazing divinity, goodness, potential, intelligence within them. And I think it's much more a matter of facilitating that when it's truly helpful and the rest of the time kind of staying out of the way and letting them become who they are rather than feeling that you have to make them into something.
Wow. But I do see, I think that idea is definitely encouraged in LDS, maybe not theology, but culture. The idea that sort of like you're on this track and we have a plan for you. I mean, my husband has told me that he felt, I mean, I think it's maybe worse in some regards for men because of the whole mission thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that he feels like his whole life was on this sort of track that,
yeah.
that had been laid out and sort of chosen for him before and that he really didn't have a hand in it. He could have deviated from it, and some people do, but, you know, and my youngest son is 7, and, I mean, he's little, so who knows, but he's already told us numerous times he doesn't want to go on a mission. He's
mm-hmm.
told us that. And then a couple of years ago, he used to tell us, too, he didn't want to get baptized. Now, that's about 6 or 8 months away, but he's just very anxious about everything. I always say
mm-hmm.
he's like nervous Nelly. Any new person, a new room, he's very tied to his routine and he doesn't like new things, new people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he said before, well, am I going to have to get baptized? And we're just like, no.
Yeah.
Do I have to go on a mission? And I said, no. But then I've also told him now, I mean, he's 7. And I'll say, no, you don't, of course, you know. But at some point, he needs to become aware. And I would not definitely push him. But I think he needs to be aware that choice can have some real detrimental consequences. I mean, I think it's bad that it's that way. But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I was at BYU, and there were, like, you know, 2 boys in my entire ward from my freshman year that didn't go on missions, and they were, like, pariahs.
Yeah.
I mean, I just remember feeling really sad for them and thinking, you know, I have no idea why they didn't choose to go, but, you know, it seems like we do have all these things that you're supposed to do, and if
yes.
you don't,
yeah.
it raises these little red flags, like, what's wrong with you, or... You know, or if someone has, you know, John lots of times talks in his interviews about people who've had a faith crisis. I think there's this idea, too, where if someone's testimony starts to falter or whatever, we want to say, like, well, what have they been up to or
yeah,
what have they
yeah.
been doing? Because it couldn't just be, you know, they must be doing something behaviorally or they must be addicted to porn. Or I mean,
yeah.
you know, I'm exaggerating, like you said, we want
to
have
the
neat.
Comfort of
right.
cause and effect.
Yes.
We want things to be predictable. We want to be able to look at them and say, well, that happened to them because of X, Y, and Z.
And so it won't happen to me.
And it's the same. This is why I have a hard time with the you're such special parents thing. Mm-hmm. I think that that's the cause and effect kind of model that we hold up to comfort ourselves that it won't happen to us because we're not nearly special enough to have a kid with disabilities. You know, those are those parents over there, you know, right. The special ones. And I'm not one of them, so I'm safe. You know, God would never give me one of these babies.
Wow.
Until he does. But I don't know. I just think about the time when we took Elizabeth to get her patriarchal blessing, and the patriarch had us come in and sit down, and he looked at us and said, okay, I want to hear what you value and appreciate about your daughter. Mm. And so this was after Thomas had been born. This is after my perspective had already started to shift. And so I looked at Elizabeth, and she's just kind of overflowing with talent. I know that sounds just so boastful, but that's just how it is. She's just that kind of kid. And I thought about all of her many gifts and capacities, you know, way beyond her academic intelligence. She has so many gifts. And so I started talking about those, you know, naming them, listing them off, and, you know, time's going by and I'm still listing all of these things that are wonderful about my daughter. And at the end, it felt so good to look at her and say, with complete sincerity, you know, may God strike me dead if I'm lying, but honey, these wonderful things about you are not why I love you. I love you because you are my daughter. Hmm. Period. And it meant the world to me to be able to say that sincerely and to know in my heart that if she could have only done 1/10 of what she's capable of doing, I wouldn't love her any less or any differently. Mm-hmm. And that's just an amazing feeling. You know, it's, you're feeling like you're finally starting to get it. You're finally starting to understand what this crazy life is all about. Mm. And it was a really powerful moment for both of us. And one that I know I'll never forget. Mm-hmm. Especially for the daughter who's been kind of a superstar in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. And you would say that you were able sort of to come to that conclusion, at least in part, because of your experience with Thomas.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because with Thomas, I had this opportunity to know what it was to love a human being without having achievement-based expectations linked and kind of mixed up with my love for them. I think, you know, it's so easy to love our brand new babies. You know, there's just this purity and this intensity of love for them, and we have so many hopes and dreams for them and so many ideas about their potential, and we just love them. And it doesn't take long for us to start to have kind of our pure love mixed up with our own needs and wants and expectations as their parents. Mm-hmm. And by the time, you know, a kid is school age, we've all got a whole bunch of ourselves mixed up in the way we approach our kids. You know, our own needs are really evident in how we address their needs. Mm-hmm. And that's, we all do it. I do, you know, I still do it. Mm-hmm. In saying all of this, I certainly don't mean to give the impression that I'm some enlightened individual who's figured it all out. All that I have figured out is that the truth, the reality is much different than what we think it is. And mm-hmm. I'm just barely starting to catch glimpses of it myself.
Okay.
You know, that's all that I can claim to know. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.